Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. So, welcome everybody. So this is a compressed sensing of a course in compressed sensing, let's say. So I'll try to convey main ideas related to some theoretical aspect of compressed sensing, giving you some insights related to the numerical methods associated to compressed sensing. And it is a sampling of a big theory by now. So, but I'll try to convey the fact that this has many different relationship with other branches of math, from simple linear algebra, if you want, to probability theory, optimization methods, and several other concepts related to information theory. And so I'll try to convey these fundamental principles. Not knowing how much people do already know about compressed sensing, I decided to start with a relatively basic concept. And although the average age in this room is not certainly 18 or 20, so I don't know, probably many people have already seen something about compressed sensing, so I don't see many undergraduate students, let's say. But this course, it's basically for master students or also PhD students, and that is designed in this way. So what is about numerical methods for compressed sensing? So we will go through some lectures that I wrote in occasion of a school that has been done at the Johanna Radon Institute for Computational Applied Mathematics. For that, we wrote a book associated to the lecture notes and the lectures. And my lecture notes, so the second chapter of this book, can be downloaded from that website, okay? And if you go to the page of the other authors of this book, let's say, you will find, basically, you can download everything from internet, so you don't need to buy the book. It's just to have you known about that, but you can download everything. In every chapter, there are some mistakes, so some of us made already the corrections. I didn't. So in case, I will point out some of the typos in the lecture notes. The course is related to numerical methods, mainly algorithms, although the first part will be more at the theoretical introduction on compressed sensing. And what is about is mainly optimization with linear constraints, but also optimization which has sparse solutions, and we will try to understand what does it mean, sparse solution. And the lectures are 9, but I didn't split them in 9, I split them in 5, but we will see how much we can do about that. There will be an introduction to compressed sensing, and I will follow a so-called information-based complexity point of view. So what does it mean? It means that we are searching for optimally solving certain problems. We will define what is this optimal. We will assume that the optimal is given by God, and that God was good with us. What does it mean, good with us? That it doesn't create something optimal only, but it gives us the chance to realize it. Okay? So that's the fact that we are going to explore. Then we will see how to realize a certain algorithms, certain methods. In particular, I will focus on these iteratively reweighted least squares. Why? It's a beautiful algorithm. Then probably I'll try to tell you something about iterative half-thresholding. And then I will move a little bit forward with respect to the theory of compressed sensing. I will move into infinite dimensional problems. The theory of compressed sensing makes sense for a certain point of view in finite dimensions, and we will try to set up some point of view in infinite dimensions, and we will talk about algorithms in infinite dimensions, and especially how can we realize these algorithms where in principle the problem is infinite dimensional, and we will try to approximate it by suitable finite dimensional sections, if you want. So why are we interested in compressed sensing or sparsity or dimensionality reduction? Well, my current research is how can I bring the concepts from compressed sensing beyond its original scope. The original scope was coding and decoding of signals. I'll try to bring this concept into more classical problems related to physics or somehow high-dimensional problems and simulation in high-dimensional problems. So moving a little bit forward with respect to the pure coding and decoding. So my idea is to try to use compressed sensing and other techniques in order to break complexity in high-dimensional problems. And that's a little bit the motivation of the work I'm currently doing from a research point of view. But in order to do that, one has to review the basics, and the basic is going to solve problems of this type. So I'll try to address three fundamental problems. Probably this, we will review them properly. The last one, I don't know whether we will have much time to do that. But the first two problems are called L0, the second L1, and they are related to solving a certain optimization problem with some linear constraints. And here, this object that we call L0N norm, it's not a norm, is a counting measure, and it is counting the non-zero entries of a vector. So we give a vector, and we are counting how many entries has this vector. And we want to find a vector which has the minimal amount of non-zero entries, which is responding to a certain linear type of constraints of this type, okay? At the same time, we would like to find relationship of this problem with another problem called L1, where L1 here now is a real a norm or a quasi-norm, and here what we have is the classical LP norms. In particular, the L1 norm is only the sum of the absolute values of the entries of the vector x. And related to this, of course, it's the solution of this problem is also, you can apply that to somehow operators acting on X. In particular, you can apply to the gradient. And instead of minimizing the L1 norm of the vector, you might want to minimize the L1 norm of the variations of the vector. So in this case, in 1D, you can think the gradient as the vector of the finite differences. And we would like to highlight the relationship between these problems and how they somehow one can solve the other one in a certain sense, and when this is possible, and things like that. So these optimizations have been recently greatly popularized, okay, in the last 5-6 years by the development of the field of non-adaptive compressed acquisition of data, which is called compressed sensing. So we'll try to understand these objectives, non-adaptive, compressed, okay? We will try to understand what does it mean, non-adaptive and compressed. In order to do that, we will have to understand what does it mean, adaptive, compressed acquisition. And we will try to understand then what does it mean, non-adaptive, compressed acquisition, okay? So, as I said, the problems we have in mind are certain optimization problems related to this theory called non-adaptive compressed acquisition of data, or shortly, compressed sensing. Okay, what is what does it mean, adaptive compression? And in order to understand the concepts from a mathematical point of view, we introduce some notations and some concepts. The first is a nonlinear set. Nonlinear means that if you take two elements of this set and you do linear combinations of them, it doesn't need to belong to the set. Okay, so we can get out of the set. So it's the set of vectors in Rn which have at most k non-zero entries. So we are counting the number of entries that they have. If the number of entries is less or equal than k, they are in the set. And we call these vectors k-sparse vectors. The best K-term approximation error is the minimal distance, in a certain sense, from of a vector from this set. So we defined this distance with respect to some norm that I called x. So basically x is usually the Euclidean space, so Rn, and done with a suitable quasi-norm or norm. Is it okay? So I call x Rn and done with some specific norm. Usually it will be LP norms, okay? So the infimum of over all the elements in the set of this distance that we are measuring through the norm is exactly the best K-term approximation error. Now we'll try to understand why it is called best K-term approximation error. And to do that, we introduce a new concept called the non-increasing rearrangement of x. So we take all the entries of x, we take the absolute value of them, and then we rearrange the indexes in such a way that these absolute values of the entries are ordered in a non-increasing way. Okay? Is there any question so far? Is everything clear? Please. Sorry? Basically, you fail to have the triangle inequality, but you have a quasi-triangle inequality in the sense that x plus y in norm is less or equal than a constant, which is not necessarily 1, can be bigger than 1, than the sum of the quasi-norm of x plus the quasi-norm of y. Okay?
Good.
Yeah, of course. I'm sorry?
You could not include norms in the rearrangement.
Yeah, we like to do that. It's the same for us. Yeah. So here you say you create this order, and then here you collect the entries without absolute values. Yeah, you can do that. For us, it's indifferent.
Okay.
So then it is quite easy to see that, in particular for the LP norms, you have that the best K-term approximation error is nothing else than the sum of the last n minus k entries of the vector Rx. Is it clear? So this should be intuitively easy to see, in the sense that basically, you want to find a vector z in sigma k, which minimizes the distance x minus z in LP. And of course, you can split this into the part on the support of z plus the part which is supported on the complement of the set of the entries of z. Okay? So of course in this part z is zero. Okay, the entries of z are zero, so it doesn't appear. Minimizing this means basically minimizing both these components. So the best possible thing is that here there are, in absolute value, the smallest possible entries of x. Okay? At the same time, the best possible thing that you can have is that on the support of z, x coincide with z in such a way that this is right equal to zero. Okay? And it's very easy to see that if you choose as z exactly the what we call the best K-term approximation, which is exactly the arc mean here, containing the as entries the largest, the k large entries of x in absolute value and all the other entries are set to zero, then this is actually the solution of the minimization problem. Okay? That's why, in a certain sense, it's very clear what happens as soon as we are considering LP norms. Okay? So, who is this guy? So, we take a vector, we look at what are the most important entries of this vector in magnitude, we keep them, and we set to zero all of the others. Okay? This is a sort of compression of X, and we know that the error that we produce in doing this procedure in a certain LP norm is exactly measured by this quantity. So it would be interesting to understand whether we can define very properly how this quantity depends on K provided X in certain classes of vectors. Okay? And these classes of vectors will tell us how many entries we need to retain in order to make this error small. Okay? This is a compression problem. Okay? We have to decide how much information we want to keep and still be able to have a small error. Okay? And this operation is adaptive. That's why it is called adaptive compression. Because we need to have a priori the vector X at our disposal in order to look for the largest entries in absolute value and then rearrange them, keep the first K and store this information. Okay? It's adaptive. It depends on the particular vector. So the measurements that we do in order to understand what is the next step has to depend on the vector X. So this is adaptive compression.
This works for P less than 1 as well, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, this equality is true also in that case. So the idea is I go to Milano. Milano is a city in Italy. I get a 10 megapixel picture X of the Duomo of Milano, and it's a big church, nice church. I go back home. I realize that the picture is too big. I compute a complete wavelet or Fourier decomposition of the image X, and eventually I keep only the best case term approximation XK with respect to wavelet or Fourier coordinates. That's adaptive acquisition of data. Okay? That's what you get. You go to Milano, you make your picture, and you store a certain amount of wavelet coefficients, and that's what you get. How many of you know about wavelets? Very precisely about wavelets. Again, I want to see, okay, who doesn't know much about wavelets? Two people. Well, two people is bigger than zero. So I just make a very short presentation of what wavelets are, but very, very short. I don't spend much time about that, okay? But this is very important to understand another concept. We are talking about sparsity and compression, okay? So, as I said, a vector X is going to be well approximated by a k-sparse vector if the corresponding k best term approximation error is small. Okay? Why can we do this assumption? Why can we allow us to think, even think, in this direction? As a matter of fact, we find that in many real-life problems, the data that we have are statistically belonging to certain classes. Okay? So let's assume that Adrian is an alien coming from some other universe. Okay? He's coming here on Earth, he's visiting a hospital, the maternity, and he gets to know that one baby came out, and this baby has two arms, two legs, one head, and it gets surprised by this strange object. But then it comes another baby, and the baby has two legs, two arms, one head, and so on. Okay? And after 1,000 baby coming out of that, he doesn't get surprised anymore, you know? He can already guess what is going to be, you know? So he's making a linear combination of the previous babies, and he gets probably something that is reasonable, okay? That's why we can expect that we can compress things. They usually belong to some statistics, okay? And as soon as you get the statistics, there should be some fundamental representation of this data that are sufficiently sparse. In a certain sense, the fundamental features of the statistics can be, if God is good with us, it should not be too complicated. So there are some features that of these statistics that we can learn. And these features usually are a good representation of the data that describe the fundamental features. Okay, you got the idea? Okay, in a certain sense, for images, wavelets are doing the job. I will not show you any wavelet. I show you only what the wavelet do. So, this is a nice picture of Van Gogh, and we see that here we do have a patch extracted from this picture, and here the corresponding digitalization, okay? So for every pixel, we can measure the corresponding gray level, and what we get here in the numbers is exactly the gray level. As you see, this part is a little bit darker, and this part is a little bit lighter, corresponding to the fact that these numbers are a little bit lower, okay, than these higher numbers. Okay, bigger numbers, and these are smaller, and that's what we get. So we get this, and we do some operations, okay? The operation is here, we do an average of these two values, and we get these numbers, but we can average these two values and get that number. So at the moment, we create the sort of compression by averaging, okay? But at the same time, we can do differencing, okay? We can take the difference between these numbers and get this other sequence. And the good news is that whatever we did here started from this, can allow us to go back exactly to this. So this sequence of numbers basically correspond to the original one and vice versa. The operations are, in a certain sense, mutually invertible. Okay? But the difference is that although here we have a sequence of numbers that is non-zero and nobody is particularly small, in this other representation, as you see, there are numbers which can get very small and numbers which get very large. Okay? So this other representation of the same data, actually, it's different, it's showing some sparsity, especially in the region corresponding in the image to discontinuities in the image. As a matter of fact, natural images are often relatively piecewise smooth. In a certain sense, they show relatively uniform part and some discontinuities, and in the discontinuities, this particular type of construction give us a sparse representation of the image corresponding to whether the image is smooth or discontinuous. We can do that instead of one row, we can do that in different directions, so horizontal, vertical, and obtaining both vertical, horizontal and diagonal information, depending on how we choose to proceed, whether horizontal and then vertical or horizontal and so on, and we get in a certain sense a 2D representation of the image by using this averaging and differencing horizontally or vertically, and this is how basically you construct a wavelet transformation. So from images which are non-sparse in principle in the pixel basis, you get the fact that in the wavelet basis you can make them very, very sparse, because this representation made of averaging and differencing is equivalent to this, so they are 1-1 transformation. but this one is particularly sparse. Taking advantage of the fact that this object has a particular statistics, and the statistics is this object usually has very few jumps, and usually it is otherwise quite smooth. Okay? And that's how we can think about compression. So you see, this object is completely reconstructed from averaging, adding differences, and we can proceed with compression. Compression is exactly what we did here. Okay? We are retaining a certain amount of entries of the vector, and we throw away all the ones that are sufficiently small. Okay? That's what we can achieve. So from now on, we are assuming that somebody gave us the right basis. Okay? Whatever is the data that we have, is an image, is a sound, is a movie, is a baby, okay? Somebody gave us a basis with respect to which this particular vector is actually sparse. And that's why it's an assumption that we use from now on. Is there any question? Okay? What does it mean?
Very good.
Okay, so it's clear.
Yes.
Okay, that's important. So we made it very clear from a very visual point of view, okay? Now you know what we are doing here, okay? We are retaining a lot of averaging, and we have been discarding a lot of the differences, okay? Very good. But let's go back to mathematics. Let's assume that our vector is already in the representation of being sparse with respect to some basis given by God. And we are asking ourselves which kind of classes of vectors with respect to that basis are actually compressible. Compressible means that the best case term approximation or the best case approximation error is small, or this relationship holds. So this comes with the following lemma that we are going to prove very quickly. And the lemma says, in a very simple way, the following. First of all, that there is a mistake in the lecture notes, because I forgot to write that Q should be strictly less than P. Okay? The second is that we have a very, very clear representation of how, or estimate of how, the best case term approximation error decay with respect to the parameter k as soon as x is given into a certain class. Okay? So we assume that we have an LQ norm or LQ quasi-norm. Okay? And here we have an LP norm with respect to a P which is larger than Q. Okay? Then we have this particular relationship. Okay? It sounds quite magical, but in a certain sense that's how it is. So we have to understand what is this XLP and how it decays, okay? For doing that, we consider lambda the support of the best k term approximation error, of the best k term approximation, okay? Or the indexes of the largest components of x in absolute value, the k best ones, okay? So we call it lambda. Usually lambda is my favorite notation for such sets. Okay? So another thing that we want to observe is that let's consider the decreasing rearrangement, which is the vector Rx, okay? and we take the Q of it, the Q powers of it. Take the Q powers of it, and this is our decreasing rearrangement. Now, let's consider the kth entry of it, corresponding to rkx to the q. And what we can say is that this area is certainly smaller than the entire area. Do you agree with me? So, means that k times rkx to the q is less or equal than the norm of x lq to the q. Is everybody convinced that this is true? Or is there anybody who doesn't see it? Okay? Adrian, I usually like my punch bowl. So, is it clear? Okay, fine. Yeah, if you want. Okay? If you want it like that. Good. So we want to use this equality, if you want. So we have k to the 1 over q of x q. So that's what we have. Okay? And we keep it in mind. Right. I'm sorry? Oh, yes, okay, no. R there is a parameter, and R there is a function. No, they are not related. One is a scalar, and R of x is the decreasing rearrangement of x. Do you remember it? Okay. So if I go too fast, please block me, yeah? Very good. So we can write this like the sum over j in... of the entries of x which are not in lambda to the p. That's what we have already discovered. We take out all the things that are not large. And if you want, you can rewrite this as x p minus q times x to the q. Okay? And now you remember that p is strictly bigger than q. This is very important. Huh? So, this is very important because now what we can say about this guy is that that guy is always less or equal than rkx. So this is less or equal than sum over j of what? Of r kx to the p minus q, xj to the q. Okay? Yeah, because these entries are some of these guys. Maybe not ordered as if they are ordered there, but they are in the tail. And this guy is particularly the last one of the good part. Okay, which is nevertheless the bigger part. Are you with me? Okay, but now we have an estimate for this, and this estimate is precisely given there. We have k to the minus p minus q divided by q of x lq to the p minus q, and here xj to the q. Now, this part does not depend anymore on j. And, of course, we can consider the sum of the entries of x in absolute value to the q, or simply estimate everything by the LQ norm to the q. So this is less or equal than k to the minus p minus q divided by q x LQ p minus q times x LQ to the q. Okay? And if you want, you can simply forget the q. Okay? But here, we started with a p power. And so if we take the 1 over P power here, and here what you get is exactly that. Okay? Are you with me? So that's the way you produce this lemma. Let's make it a little bit concrete. So we give some names to P and Q. For instance, we like to give P equal to 1, P equal to 2, and Q equal to 1, or something less or equal than 1 if you want, but at the moment equal to 1. And what we get is that if your vector x belongs to some L1 norm ball, what is the L1 norm ball? Is the ball of vectors which has L1 norm less or equal than 1. Okay? Which means that if I choose here 1, I can estimate this by 1. And here we have a 2, so we have sigma k of x in L2 is less or equal than 1 times k to the minus 1 over 2. And we have a very precise decay of the best case term approximation error. Okay? So, there is the baby basis, the basis for which any baby can be described with few parameters. Okay? And you find that this is a good basis because for any baby that comes out is in L1 ball of with a certain norm. Are you with me? That's the concept. Please. Why I consider 1 for LQ? Because I'm trying to respond to the first question. What can be a good class of object of sets in Rn for which I can expect the vector x to be well approximated by its best case term approximation? Okay. First of all, we need to understand what does it mean approximation. Approximation assumes that we have a distance. So we need to define a norm to be able, or a distance, to say something about the difference between these two vectors. Okay? And that's the role of the LP. Are you with me? But then we need to find an object, a set, that can be, in a certain sense, our set of compressible vectors. Okay? And now I show you why LQ balls for Q small are compressible vectors. Because if you see how an LQ ball is with respect to the L2 ball, you see that this is a relatively slim and skinny object, where in a certain sense, most of the vectors can be assume having sparse patterns as characteristics. Actually, I would like to drive you an attention to a paper by Jan Wibiral. Jan Wibiral, which has tried to create a suitable concept of sparse random vector. Okay? What does it mean? You generate some probability, you have a distribution for which the vectors that comes out of distributions are nicely compressible. Okay? And the way he does is to construct suitable probability distribution using LQ balls. Okay, it's a very recent paper appeared on constructive approximation, I think. It's Wibiral, Wibiral, in this way, Jan Wibiral with a Y. Wibiral, I'm sorry, Jan Wibiral. constructive approximation. I consider this distribution that he finds the distribution for defining random sparse vectors. Okay? It's a very beautiful construction. Probably it's not that simple. The way the people produce it, usually sparse vectors, is just taking k entries non-zero at random. So you take k uniformly at random entries, which are non-zero, and these entries, for these entries, they use some Gaussian distribution. Okay? This is a nice construction, not realistic. Okay, it's nice because it's easy to handle. Everything is uniform and Gaussian, and things are easy. Handling the probability distribution constructed by Yang is a little bit more complicated, but is more realistic. Okay, so why are we interested in this? Because if you want to have an algorithm, if you want to have some procedure that should work well for most of the sparse vectors, okay, you want to try to make randomization of your procedure, assuming that you are generating your vectors according to that distribution, then taking the estimated value and all this stuff, and see what happens afterwards. Are you with me? However, this is what would have been the best to do. It's hard to use this distribution, but it's a good one. Okay? So that's why are we interested to these objects. Are you with me? Okay. Now, we understood what does it mean adaptive compressed acquisition. Okay? And now we get into a little bit more mysterious point of view. What is the non-adaptive compressed acquisition? We have to digest the concept. Okay? And it takes a little bit of effort to do that. Okay? We have to get out of certain schemes, because anytime you get to compression as a concept, everybody is thinking exactly adaptive compressed acquisition, because this is something that we have already digested. It's in our blood. Okay, we have to digest the non-adaptive compressed acquisition. It takes a while, and we go slowly in that. Now, as I said, the adaptive compressed acquisition depends on the vector. We need to know the vector a priori, the entire vector, in order to decide which are the most important entries. Okay? And we need to take the entire vector, acquiring, sensing the complete vector before being able to say which are the most important components. Okay? The question is, can we, if we want to compute the k best entries of the vector, can we make exactly k measurements of this vector instead of computing the entire vector, and from these k measurements being able automatically to infer and compute the largest components of the vector? Okay? So in the adaptive compressed acquisition, we need to do n measurements. We need to measure every entry. And out of this entry, we get the largest ones. Okay? Now I'm telling you, I'm allowing you to make different measurements. You can measure the vector in a certain sense at once by a sort of averaging sensing. And I can give you the opportunity to do that k times. Is there a way, first of all, to design such measurements in such a way some method can extract out of this information exactly those k most important entries? And what I make even more complicated is the measurements that we did should not depend on the particular vector. Okay? Now this blah, 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 we make it mathematics. So, we would like to describe what I call a linear encoder, which allows us to compute approximately k measurements which I called Y1 and YK, and the nearly optimal approximation of X. What does it mean, nearly optimal? It would like the following. We provided a set K of vectors, okay? It might be all over N, actually, okay? Might be all over N. And we would like a map A, being linear, mapping from Rn to Rm, okay? Where M, we would like to be of the same order of K, okay? We would like M basically being K. At the moment, we are confusing the two guys. M and K will be a little bit the same for us. And we would like to have a map, which might be any map, can be linear, nonlinear, such that that gets any vector in our M or our K, and it gets back. And what we want is that the vector that we created by linear encoding can be decoded into a vector that has a distance from X, which is of the same order as the best K-term approximation. Are you with me? In the same norm. Are you with me? So, but this big error is of the same, I said, of if you plug xk here, what you have, x minus this, is less or equal than c, x minus xk. So you want this to be at the same order of the best k-term approximation. Okay? If you want error at the end in order to take into account this, I agree with you. I understand what you mean. Okay? Are you with me? Be careful. Be careful. It's also nonlinear in the sense that assume that you take A, the identity, mapping Rn into Rn. Okay? So M is equal to N. Okay? Good. What is delta? Well, delta is a nonlinear map. Why? Because you have to do the rearrangement of the entries. And then making a cut, a thresholding, if you want. It's a nonlinear map. So even in the adaptive acquisition, okay, these two maps, one of the two maps might be nonlinear, okay? What we want to do here is, first of all, A, it's universal, and we make M the smallest possible with respect to the fifth K. The hope is that M can get as close as possible to K and becoming K, possibly. Okay? Delta, of course, depends in a certain sense on X. Okay? Because it will depend on A of X. So we need this information to go back. So, but decoding, how we code is independent of X.
So delta is constructed taking information about how A X is. The information coming from A.
Yeah.
So it's learning about.
No, it's as an input. Yeah. So it's not constructed. Okay? It has an input, it's a function. Okay? It has an input. Okay? At the moment, AX. Okay. Yeah. The bad news is that this is the wish. Okay? So.
Do we keep track of how big C is in the story?
Big?
Do we need?
Oh, yes. That's, we would like a C not be too large, of course. And, of course, there are some optimal constants here that comes out of our theory. Okay? And we will find it. Okay, not optimal. We'll find some constants. in practice they are better than it is written here in the real life, but we can compute them. So there are some constants that we can compute. Okay, so this is our wish, and we want to know whether God can satisfy our wish. You tell me when I should stop for the first break.
Oh, it's up to you. So, do you want to have 2 breaks in the morning or 1 break? Maybe 1 break.
Yeah, 1 break. Yeah.
And you decide when it's a natural stopping break.
Okay. Let me see what is a natural stopping place. Okay. The natural stopping place is after this slide. So let's repeat. The way we encode X via prescribed map A, which is independent of X, as well as the coding procedure. The coding procedure, it's designed to be independent of X in the sense that it's always the same procedure that takes X as an input. It's a parametric with respect to X. Okay? But in a certain sense, A is the crucial issue. We will compute a number of parameters from X, which is proportional in terms of its number to the number of the best K entries of X, and the decoding procedure will be able to compute a vector which is of the same order in terms of our approximation as the best K term approximation error. There will be a universal objective that comes out of this story that I'm going to tell you later. We recover an approximation to X, which is nearly k linear from nearly k linear measurements, which is of the same order of the k best approximation error. In that sense, we say that this coding and decoding system is nearly optimal. Okay, it's perform almost the best possible approximation of X in terms of K non-zero parameters. We will play with that. You will find that yeah. Okay. So let's stop here, have another coffee or extra coffee, and we continue in
just make a quick
yeah.
remark. If you go back to your lemma.
Right.
Yeah, I just want people to realize that it's a nice estimate because it shows you that the smaller Q is,
the better it is.
The better your
right. Yeah. So
the smaller your
case. Exactly. The smaller is Q. So that's why we allow Q to be even less than 1 if you want. Okay? As a matter of fact, in this course we are dealing mainly with the L1 ball, but theory goes also for LQ balls for Q less than 1. It's the extreme situation, yeah. Okay, so let's stop here and we continue with the next steps here. Not to record my drinking coffee. Well, how can I do that? Okay. Right.
For this to work, the basic assumption seems to me kind of like if you have a signal that you want to compress sense or something, then the information about the k largest entries, according to whatever basis is given to us, has to be kind of well distributed in the signal, right? And not hidden somehow. So that the measurement can be chosen. Otherwise, if you have to have very, very good knowledge about the signal, to place the...
You don't want to know anything about it.
So that means that the signal itself, the class of signals for which this works are signals where the information is well distributed.
You have an intuition, but it's not the right one.
Okay.
I try to explain that to you. So actually, for some, you will see that we can do that for some x, being k, all of the Euclidean space. No structure on the x. The fact is that a cannot be sampling the entries of x, because if a is simply sampling the entries of x, it gets m entries and maybe is missing the big ones for most of the vectors in our n, okay? Which means that it should be sort of the opposite. Instead of picking entries, should test all of them with a sort of democratic attitude, okay? Because everybody can be the bigger guy, okay? We are in America. In Europe is different, but here everybody has the opportunity, you know? So you should not have an A testing one entry, but you should have A testing every entry at the same time, okay? Giving the chance to everybody to be. So we'll find out who A should be, or which kind of A's you should have. Okay, in order to, now we express our wish, okay, and now we question whether this wish is legitimate. So can we really realize such ambitious attitude, okay? And in particular, well, the ambitious attitude can be realized, there's no doubt. If you take m equal to n, we know at least one way to do that, the adaptive compressed acquisition. But we want to make m strictly less than n, possibly very close to k. Okay? That's the ambitious attitude that we want to have now. So the optimal performance is to understand the relationship between k and m and how they do scale from one with respect to the other one. So we put, again, we are again in a sort of God point of view, okay? We are really, really looking for a very general statement independent of the particular A, delta we are using. And this is point of view is called information-based complexity point of view. Okay, so I'm following more or less the some beautiful attitude that Ron DeVore, for those who knows his name, follow concerning numerical methods. You have a problem to be solved with a certain amount of effort to compute a certain amount of quantities that approximate your solution. So it is legitimate to question yourself, provided a certain error, provided a certain approximation distance, okay, what is the best possible algorithm to do that? And the best possible means, usually, an algorithm which has a complexity proportional to that quantity. Can we realize it? Is it possible? Is a problem that allows us to do that? Some problems don't allow us to do that. Some problems have a complexity that are exponential in the parameters of the problem. Okay? So once established what is the complexity of the problem with respect to a certain approximation error, we would like to see whether it's possible to realize it. Okay? So we first somehow look at the problem from a very general point of view, and then we try to see whether our findings, optimal findings, can be realized. So here we have two quantities. The first is easy to understand. The second is a little bit more complicated to understand. Okay? So the first to understand is simply we consider a class of vectors. In our mind, this class can be always L1. Okay? The L1 norm. Are you with me? So here we consider the L1 norm, the L1 ball, sorry, the L1 ball. And we take the supremum of the best k-term approximation error with respect to another norm, x. Okay? For instance, if you take x, the L2, the Euclidean space with the Euclidean norm, and k, the L1 ball, we know already what this quantity is. This quantity is less or equal than k to the minus 1 over 2. We computed before. Are you with me? So this is a not very mysterious concept. This is a little bit more mysterious concept. So we are considering, out of this class, the worst performance provided by a certain coding and decoding system. The coding is given by this linear map, and the decoding system is given by delta. Okay? And we are looking at the error provided by this coding and decoding system, and the worst case error possible in that class. Out of this worst case scenario, we take the best possible coding and decoding system. So we are looking for the best couple A and delta with the properties that we have been already discussing. Okay? What is clear is that if this has to be true for all of X in a certain class K, then this has to be true. Because we take the supremum in both sides with respect to k, and then on the left-hand side, we take the infimum over all the possible coding and decoding couples. And what we get is that whatever is the thing we do here, on the right-hand side, we need this inequality to hold. Are you with me? Any question? So, please. I said, you take the supremum of x over k, both sides, and on the left-hand side, you take the infimum over all the possible coding and decoding pairs. Here, you have exactly supremum and infimum, and then supremum on the right-hand side. Are you with me? Is it clear now? Actually, C naught is the same. Okay? It's just to, please. They can be the same, but the game doesn't play nicely. Well, you'll see it. Okay? So the point is that if you take the L1 norm here of the L of vectors in the L1 ball, actually you don't have any good way to estimate the sigma k. Are you with me? Okay. So, now let's assume that this is true, and we want to find whether we can find some relationship between M and M. So this inequality will be transformed into some inequality involving K and M. Why? Because this, you know already that is basically K to the minus 1 over 2, if we want to specify it in a suitable norm. Are you with me? And here, in a certain sense, you have another quantity depending on M. The only trouble is to find a way to make it explicit. Okay? So, we would like to find the largest K or the smallest M such that this is true. Okay? We respond to this question for the particular case K equal to B, L1, and for Euclidean space. Are you with me? What we will find, and this is quite disappointing, is that it's impossible to reconstruct the vector BL1 with an accuracy asymptotically for m and n larger and larger of the order of the k best term approximation error if k is exactly m. It's impossible. But it is necessary to have a slightly larger number of measurements, which means that m has to be slightly bigger than k. And the slightly bigger is given by this non-negative, actually positive object here that we have to define. Okay? Are you with me? So that's the finding that we are going to detect. How do we do that? We do that through taking advantage of old results. Old results coming from studies of the old Russian school in approximation theory, related to a concept which is actually related to the thing that we are discussing right now, but apparently very far apart. Okay? The concept is called Galfen-Width. So the Galfen-Width is usually related to a compact set, K, in X. So X is our Euclidean set space. You take a compact set in it, you may translate the compact set into the origin if you want, and you are looking for the following geometrical geometrical object. What is this geometrical object? Well, it seems very complicated, but it's much easier to picture it. So we have our compact set K. We consider a subspace of X. So this is X. We take a subspace of X, we call it Y, and we want this subspace being of codimension M. So the codimension Y, codimension, is, say, less or equal than M. What is the codimension? Is the dimension of X minus the dimension of Y. Okay? So, now we consider the intersection. So this is Y intersected with K. So it is this sort of segment in this picture. And out of this, we are considering the largest norm of a vector in this intersection. Okay? And now, among all the possible y's, we try to find the one which give us the slimmest possible, the smallest possible value of this x. Now, in this object, it's difficult to understand which one of them. Okay, but maybe that one is the good one. Maybe, I don't know. But yeah, this might be the y star if you want. The vertical one, maybe you're right. The vertical one is a good one. Yeah, thank you. Okay, and that is exactly telling us that this object, in this particular, so it has a certain width, okay? Minimal width in a certain direction, okay? And that's the so-called Galfen-Width. No. Maybe we will implicitly have it here in the certain properties that we see afterwards, but not for the definition in general of the Galfen-Width. Actually, you can compute Galfen-Width of LQ balls for Q less than 1, which are non-convex, but you want some properties, typical properties that convex sets have. For instance, you want that somehow you want some dilation property. Okay, but this is true for also LQ balls, so that would be okay. Okay?
We don't require actually the
space. Yeah, there is a trouble here. I don't know. there is a point in the proof that we are going to see where might be finite dimension relevant. Okay?
Okay.
Let's give a look. Maybe you are interested in searching in that. Okay? I cannot say that. I have to give a look how it works, and I don't know.
There's a place where you can read about the Gelfand width of the tuple.
Yeah, there is a lot of literature, and I give you.
Okay.
So in the lecture notes, there are references about that. But I remind you the results also from the guys who did it. Okay, now we have this proposition here. And this proposition is making a relationship between, actually a rather special relationship between our optimal coding and decoding error and the corresponding Gelfand width. Okay? Which is quite surprising, because this is a geometrical quantity on a certain object, okay? And this is how good can we provide a coding and decoding system for our method, okay? So let's try to prove this proposition. And to do that, we actually we don't prove the proposition completely. We prove only one direction, so we prove only this one, and this one I just refer to the lecture notes, okay? So we don't get into the full details of this proof. There will be plenty of other proof that I want to show you, so at least you get a flavor about that. So actually for this part you will need this dilation and this symmetry property to hold. And for the first part, I think that you need just the symmetry property. So proof. So it is quite convenient to rewrite who EMK is the infimum over all the coding and decoding pairs over the supremum of X in K of X minus delta AX with respect to X. That's what we want to estimate later. One important fact that makes a little bit easier to understand what this quantity have to do with the other is the relationship between matrices and spaces. So if I have a matrix in Rm times n, then what can we say about the null space of this matrix? Well, the null space has codimension less or equal than what, than m. Okay? So it will be interesting, given A, we can associate y given by the null space of A. Okay? Conversely, given Y, we can consider a orthonormal basis for the orthogonal space of Y, and such basis will form the rows of a corresponding matrix A. So given A, we can have Y. Given Y, we can have A. Okay?
This is an orthogonal projection.
No, this is not an orthogonal projection. This is the orthogonal space to Y. So this is all the Euclidean space. Okay? Ah, the A is the orthogonal. Yeah, okay. So with this identification, we can write dm of x of k in norm x equal to the infimum, instead of the infimum over all the y's with codimension blah blah blah, infimum over all the matrices m times n of the supremum of what? Of eta in x, such that eta belongs to the null space intersection to k. Okay? That's the interesting fact. Now, provided such, provided A and delta in AMN, in the our coding and decoding system, define Z equal to delta of zero. So you give me any coding and decoding system, I take the decoding and I compute Z being the delta of zero. Okay? Observe now that, for all eta in the null space, it follows that either eta minus z is bigger than eta, or minus eta minus z is bigger than eta. And why this is the case? Wow. Complicated. Do I do the right thing? Oh, there is automatic thing?
Analog thing.
Huh? Ah. Wow, that's cool. Okay, why? Because if that was not the case, okay, you can simply write this eta minus zeta plus zeta minus eta less or equal than eta minus zeta plus minus zeta, yeah. And if this was not the case, then we would have necessarily strictly less than eta plus eta equal to eta, and we will have a contradiction, okay? You see that, right? I'm sorry? So we start with 2 eta, we do some triangle inequality. At some point here, we assume that we don't have those relationship to hold, both of them, we use it and we get into a contradiction. So, now, since minus n is equal to n and minus k is equal to k, so the kernel is a linear space, so minus itself is itself, we are assuming that K is symmetric, we conclude what? Dm of K in X is the infimum over all A in our M times N of what? Of the supremum over the eta in the null space of K, in the intersection of the null space and K. As we said, this is symmetric, we can take eta or minus eta, is the same, so we can certainly write this as the supremum over eta in the intersection with respect to the null space and K of any specific A. Okay, we fixed some A at some point. For instance, the A that we fixed up there, and what we get is that this is less or equal than eta minus zeta. If it is minus, eta is the same, because we have been discussing that before. And if it is not, we take the plus. If it is not, we take the minus, it's the same. Okay? And this is equal to what? This is the supremum over eta in N intersection with K of eta minus, what is Z? Z has been fixed being the delta of zero. And zero is the result of A applied to eta. So this is delta of zero, but eta is in null space of A, so you can write something like that. Okay? Well, but this is always less or equal than the supremum over X in K of X minus delta A X X. Okay? And now, everything here, basically up to this point, holds for any couple A and delta. So if you want, you can take the infimum here over the couple A and delta, and you get the first inequality. That is this inequality. Okay? With similar games, you can prove the other inequality. Okay? So this is basically finishing the first lower bound. Is it okay? Very good. So, we found this important relationship that there is a complete, somehow asymptotic behavior with respect to this quantity and the Gelfand-Witt. So, now we would like to understand what is the relationship between Gelfand-Witt. Okay? So, what can we say about Gelfand-Witt? And this was in a certain sense, a source of an incredible amount of research, starting in the 70s and continuing in the early 80s, in the community of the people working on certain aspects of compact embeddings. So it is related to compactness of certain operators to understand how balls are. Okay? So you know that when you decide that an operator is compact, has to send closed sets into compact sets, and how far you are from compactness, you want to understand how bad you are with respect to compactness. It turns out that measuring somehow the certain width of your balls can give you some understanding on how bad you are. Okay, and that's the game that they were basically playing at that time. And they made a complete work, at least for the LP balls, for P bigger than 1, okay, bigger or equal than 1. For P strictly bigger than 1, they understood exactly, so for LQ with Q bigger than 1 and P bigger than Q, they found the exact asymptotics with respect to the parameters N and M, and this game was not that complicated. It took a lot of time to understand exactly how to prove this scaling. Okay? For the case Q equal to 1 and P equal to 2, which is our friend. Okay? This is the case that we are continuing to insist on. And as we will see, we will implicitly prove this statement later on. But the way to prove it, unfortunately, goes through the same difficulties that they find at that time to prove this statement. Okay? I don't reveal you at the moment what is the difficulty. Okay? I will tell you later. Okay? Just believe that in particular for the case Q equal to 1 and P equal to 2, this is the exact scaling. Okay? We have this beautiful complete description of the story. Okay? Yes. Good. And now, since we have been playing with the case P equal to 2, Q equal to 1, let's put it into practice. So let's assume that this is what we want, and let's see which kind of relationships come out. So we have been saying from before, may I delete here? Everybody has been... What do we find? Okay, we found that EM of KX is basically DM of KX. And DM KX is something like the minimum between 1 and the square root of logarithm of N divided by M plus 1 divided by M. And we would like this to be some constant of sigma k x of k of x. Now, k is the L1 ball, x is the Euclidean norm, the Euclidean space with the Euclidean norm, and we have already seen that this is basically k to the 1 over 2. Okay? Are you with me? Or, yeah, if you want, square root of 1 over k. Very good. Now, if n is sufficiently large, okay, and m is sufficiently large, you see that the minimum between these two quantities is this one. Let's take, I don't know, N1000, M100, the logarithm of 10. It's small, okay, plus 1. And here we have 100. So you see that the minimum of the two is really the guy on the right. So let's assume that N is 1 million, M is, okay, you agree with me? So we can, in a certain sense, delete this. Okay? Very good. What do we get? We get exactly that k has to be bigger than some constant C0 m logarithm of n divided by m plus 1. So this is necessary. Okay? This is a necessary condition. So, our wish... Yeah. Our wish has to be realized if k is sufficiently smaller than n. Actually, this log factor for a reasonable amount of dimensions, so if you take here some millions, it's still okay. Okay? But, so in a certain sense, there is a almost linear scaling between x and n, except this log factor. Okay? So, except the log factor, we do have a nice scaling between x and m, but it's not exactly linear. Okay? So now we found that our wish can be realized, maybe, only if this is true. Okay? So it's limitations which is intrinsic and provided by a very, very general point of view. Now, okay, we know that if our wish can be realized, it has some intrinsic limitations. Okay? The problem is, we have been talking about the optimal coding and decoding pair. One is linear, okay, it's a nice matrix, but can we really generate this matrix for any m and n, first of all? Second, there is this delta decoder. You know, the delta decoder for the identity map is the rearrangement. It's a sorting procedure, n log n, okay? But who knows what happens when we are asking that m gets closer to k? Might be that the delta, the optimal delta, is a map that does not allow us to be computed in a reasonable time. So it might be that the complexity is dramatically changing. Okay, so it's not anymore a polynomial complexity in the dimension, might becoming an exponential complexity. How can we do that? Okay, so now we would like to explore whether our wish not only is possible, provided certain limitations, but it can really be realized, okay, and can be really useful. So first of all, we would like to investigate the decoding procedure, okay, the delta. We want to understand how bad a delta can be. We will show in particular that if the coding system, so this matrix, has a certain property that depends on k, then we can construct a delta that is actually optimal. And this delta has a polynomial complexity. Okay? That's what we want to show. Therefore, later, we want to prove that there exists such a linear coder with this property, with k optimal. So with k that can scale up to this value. Are you with me? So the first step we do is that, provided a certain matrix with a certain property, which I'm going to call the null space property, okay, with a certain parameter k, then L1 minimization in particular will be our delta with a certain optimality properties. Okay? Are you with me? Moreover, we will prove later that there will be matrices that have this property with a k that scales exactly like that. Therefore, we will have concluded that such an optimal coding and decoding pair exists, and the coding procedure will be done by linear map, and the decoding procedure will be done by a nonlinear map whose application can be performed in polynomial time. Is it clear? Very good. So we want to show that under this property, null space property depending on k for a matrix A, this decoder, which is the minimization of the L1 norm on any vector x, actually we should put z here, there is a typo, so x is the guy that we want to find, and that any competitor z minimizes the L1 norm among all of those that are solving the linear system. This particular decoder that has to know only the result of the linear map applied to X performs in particular this inequality, which is one instance of the inequalities that we were looking for X being L1, the L1 norm. But this might disappoint my friend over there that wanted to know whether we can put L1, L1. Actually, we can put L2. But in that case, unfortunately, it has been shown that L2 cannot be realized. but it can be realized L2, L1 with this scaling. And as you see, as soon as your vector x was in an L1 ball, this is exactly the scaling that we are looking for all the time, this square root of 1 over square root of k. Okay? So we will show that actually our L1 norm, L1 normalization, do perform this. Now, what we want to also to show later is that k can be really boosted up to the optimal. Can be really boosted up to this point. Okay? So we will have to find A with a null space property with optimal k. But we will try to understand that later on. Are you with me? Yeah, we will compute them implicitly, depending on the null space property. It's quite a complicated construction. You can get the constants, okay? It's all a chain of construction, okay? Unfortunately, those constants will hold with a certain probability, okay? That's, please. What does it mean? Yeah, of course, we have some technique that gives an estimate of these constants, but the optimal ones, yeah, they are open, but the ones that we have, they hold with high probability too. So we will see how it works. It's a very complicated construction. So since everybody is so interested to constants, I will keep it in mind, and I will try to recover at the end of the story those constants, how they come out, okay? Good. So, an intuition why L1 minimization might work. A consequence of these two inequalities are the following. First of all, you see that they do work for any x in R(n). Okay? In particular, if you want to restrict it to L1 ball, you're free to do that. Okay? But certainly, these inequalities must hold for every x in Rn, okay? In particular, we can take an x which has only k non-zero entries, okay? So what is, what's your name? Craig. What is the k-best approximation error of a vector x which has k non-zero entries? The error. Bravo. Which means that if I'm encoding a k sparse vector into the vector y, then this decoding procedure should be able to reconstruct the vector exactly. Okay? You give me a sparse vector, I don't know which are the entries of this vector which are activated. I applied my matrix that gives me back m parameters. Whatever it is in these m parameters, it's sufficient for me to recover exactly x, and in particular it's k non-zero entries. Okay? Magical. So, as I said, if the vector x is in the k-sparse set, then the recovery is exact. This is a result is quite surprising. Why? Because it is known that if you take a generic matrix A and you try to make the job of minimizing the amount of non-zero entries of a solution of the linear system, this problem is actually NP complete. What is NP? NP is the class of problems for which it's possible to test that a certain object is the solution of the problem in polynomial time. By the way, it's not computing the solution is in, you can do that in polynomial time. You can test that a certain object that you give to me is a solution, and I can do that in polynomial time. For such problems, in general, we don't know whether there are polynomial algorithms to compute the solution. That's the trouble with these problems. Okay? And actually, this is the so-called NP equal P problem. The other class is the class of problems for which computing the solution is a polynomial complexity problem. So we don't know whether such problems have a polynomial complexity solutions. Actually, please. Very good. Okay, I didn't know that. Fantastic. Okay. Everything is recorded. Thank you. Sorry. So yeah, that's fine. And so actually, this is one of actually these problems can be shown to be equivalent to each other. And this can be shown to be equivalent to some problems in the NP class, and therefore, in general, cannot be solved in polynomial time as soon as we know. But the L1 minimization can be performed in polynomial time. So we have algorithms, and I show you some of them that proceed with the construction and the solution of the problem in polynomial time. So there is a contradiction, apparently. Okay? No, there's no contradiction because we are restricting the matrices A to a very specific class. It's the class of matrices for which we have a special property called mass-based property. Okay? But it's quite interesting to understand how large is this class, how close these two problems are. Okay? So that's an interesting issue. So that's what we have, and that's why it's a bit surprising to discover that L1 minimization do have such coding and decoding, this decoding type of properties. Okay, let's try to understand what does it mean, why there is a relationship between the L0 minimization and the so-called L1 minimization. I'm Italian, please.
Can I ask something about the nature of the density? This all the n squared entered through output, is that equivalent? Is that what algorithms are actually used yet for the system?
No, this is just done, I think, for a certain interior point methods. But we will show algorithms that might perform better than that. Okay. Okay. So, for instance, I don't know whether we will have time, but yeah. There are algorithms that those complexity depend on the sparsity of the solution, okay, and not on n, in a certain sense. So we'll try to figure out the homotopy method, so-called homotopy method, or we will see. Or we will depend on the matrix vector multiplication as well. For instance, if you have the matrix A being a partial Fourier matrix, you can apply this matrix in n log n. And if you use an iterative algorithm, and you can prove that this iterative algorithm converge with the linear, you can get the solution up to an epsilon with a certain number of iterations, depending on epsilon, and every iteration costs n log n. So I think that you can do a little bit better than this. There are some direct methods that those complexity depends on k or k squared, and yeah, and there are iterative algorithms where for certain matrices you can get a complexity that is n log n in the yeah, so you can get better than that. Okay. For L1 minimization, then exists a huge class of other algorithms, so-called greedy algorithms like orthogonal match impulses and variations on the theme, and also these are having a certain good complexities and things like that, but they are not based on L1 minimization. They're based on greedy strategies to compute the sparse solution. Yeah, and so, yeah. But they solve the same problem eventually, so, but not using L1 minimization principle. Then there is another algorithm that I'm going to present that is in principle costing m cube times the number of iterations that you have to do. It's basically linear or even superlinearly convergent. So in here there will be a factor depending on the accuracy you want to achieve. Yeah, so. Okay, I'm Italian. And Italians, when the problem is too complicated, they relax. Okay, they just take it easy, you know. We do the same, we relax the problem. Okay, so the so-called convex relaxation. So what we are minimizing is the number of non-zero entry of a vector, and the number of non-zero entry of a vector is a non-convex function of the vector itself. And if you want, you can write it as a sum of these L0 naught entries, where the absolute value naught of the entries, where the absolute value naught is the function that gives you zero if the vector is zero, if the entry is zero, one otherwise. So what is a convex envelope or convex relaxation of the function? It's the maximal convex function which is smaller than the function itself. Okay? So you have a non-convex function that you want to minimize, and you want to find a convex function which is smaller than this function, but is the maximal one. Okay, the maximal convex envelope. Why are you interested to this convex approximation from below? Because there are some relatively general theorems that tells you that if your function is the original function is lower semi-continuous, defined on a convex set, and is bounded from below, and you find this convex envelope, the minimizer of the convex envelope actually corresponds to the global minimizer of a non-convex function, of your original non-convex function. And here you can see that geometrically, quite nicely in a certain sense, that the the global minimizer of the convex function corresponds to the global minimizer of the non-convex function. But what is the advantage? The advantage is that if your non-convex convex function, your convex envelope, is not a nasty function. Nasty means that it's particularly non-smooth. Then you can design algorithms based on steepest descent. So you check whether the approximate derivative of the derivative of the subgradient of the convex function point, and you proceed in the opposite direction. At some point, these algorithms, by a certain number of iterations, they do converge to your global minimizer. Okay? So if you have a very difficult problem, you relax, you make it convex, and you try to minimize the convex relaxation. All right? What is the convex relaxation of the L0 norm? Let's assume that our problem is actually confined in some L infinity ball, which means that all the entries of the vector have at most value R in absolute value. Okay? So we are on a convex ball. Everybody is between minus R and R. This is our function absolute value naught, and we have to find the maximal function, which is smaller, maximal convex function, which is smaller than the absolute value naught, in this convex set, which is our L infinity ball. Well, it has to be 0 in 0, it has to be 1 in R, and what we get is that this is the best thing you can do. Other that we can even write is 1 over R, the absolute value of T. Okay? So without further restrictions, the convex relaxation of the L of the L0 on this set, on the L infinity ball, is the L1 norm multiplied by 1 over R. So minimizing